Ladies and gentlemen, it is December 29th. We are here. Mariachi El Bronx will be playing. Mike Dillon Band will be playing. And of course, The Mighty Clutch is headlining. And I have the distinct pleasure of talking to Jean-Paul, the drummer.
Good afternoon, sir. Thank you.
First of all, were you able to have a nice holiday?
Yeah, it was good. We wrapped up our European tour just prior to Christmas time. We were home just long enough to do a few Christmassy kind of things and back out on the road again.
Absolutely. And no one would have blamed you if you would have been like, hey, we just got back from Europe, you know, let's chill for the rest of the year. But we appreciate you tacking on a couple extra dates.
Well, thank you very much. And we're very appreciative of all the folks that are going to come and see us tonight. And, you know, this run that we do every year is sort of it's become kind of a yearly thing, you know, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of folks are home for the holidays or maybe visiting family for the holidays. And so it's got kind of a real celebratory kind of vibe. And that's part of the reason why we chose Mariachi El Bronx and the Mike Dillon Band, because it's kind of a party vibe.
Very festive, yeah. All right, so it's well known that the band switches up the set list each night with a different member dictating that. Out of curiosity, whose night is it tonight?
Tonight would be Neil's night. Okay. Then Tim. We always start with Dan, and then myself, and then Neil, and then Tim. That is alphabetical order of first name. I'm not sure why we decided on first name, but at the time it was brilliant. That was about 20 years ago, I think, where we came up with this concept. So it's worked. So we just keep doing it.
Yeah, you're not going to change now. So
no, it would be really confusing. Could you imagine if we try to go back to last names now? Forget it. No one would know what to do.
The middle names? Yeah.
No, it's way too confusing.
Cool. All right, so do you have a bucket of like 30 well-rehearsed songs that you pick from, or is there any room for someone to call for a deep cut?
Sure, we call for deep cuts all the time. And in fact, last night we played Frankenstein off of Pure Rock Fury. I don't think we played that song in probably 15 years. We had Mike Dillon up there with us last night. So it was fun to try that song. You know, sometimes when you haven't played a song for a while, you go back to it, and how you remembered the song is not really how you end up playing it. You know, it kind of, that song can evolve. So we're not adverse to that. We try to keep a wide variety of songs to pull from. I'm quite sure that we have even more than 30 songs to pull from. Sometimes, you know, sometimes when I'm making a set list, I'll try to make a set list that's completely different from the one before. No repeats, you know. So, yeah, I think we're for us to be able to pull from so many different songs, I think keeps the shows exciting, keeps us interested, you know. And I think the fans have come to expect that of us as well.
Absolutely. And I think I saw on Facebook, does Tim usually post the set list after the fact?
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Excellent. Because that's really appreciative. It's good. It's almost like a snapshot of the experience. And then you can also, I don't know, it makes my job easier too, just keeping track of that stuff. But yeah.
Sure.
All right, so the touring in support of Psychic Warfare, still in stores now, winds down. Have you been finding yourself digging into some of the, I don't know, I don't want to say less obvious tracks, but with Earthrocker, you were able to pretty much play all of those songs live very seamlessly. Do you find the same experience with Psychic Warfare?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that had a lot to do with us playing the material as much as we did before we even recorded it. You know, once we had the sort of body of work ready to go, once we knew that we had, you know, 12, 13 songs, 14 songs even. We started just playing those songs and play and play and play. And we kept that up even while we were in the studio. So even when, you know, even when we were going to track drums, we started every day just by playing every tune all the way through. And the idea was to not micromanage the tune, was to play the song, you know, just get a feel for it, and then play all the other material as well, and that way you kind of get a vibe as to what the entire record is going to be like. And I found that to be very helpful when it actually came trying to start tracking the material. You know, you sort of have an idea of the overall body of work, and it made it easier for me to track drums that way.
And if you do some of the songs live, which you did X-Ray Vision on that tour, you can also sort of gauge reactions and maybe, I don't want to say make adjustments based on that, but, you know, maybe make adjustments.
Absolutely, yeah. The primary job of this band is to play live. So that means playing this new material live. You have to do that. For me, that's really the test of the song, you know. You can come up with what you think is a great idea, but as soon as you get up on stage and you put it in front of a crowd, what you thought was great maybe isn't so great, maybe something that you were neglecting before really comes to life. The live scenario is definitely a proving ground for the song, and the more we do that, I feel like the better version of that song is ultimately going to get recorded.
So over the last few years, albums, whatever, has considering how the song would translate live become more of a factor as you were writing, or has it always been?
Okay, absolutely. You know, for us, I think that's just part of the journey of becoming better songwriters. You know, we take a lot of time when we craft these songs because we want it to be something that translates live. You know, we want there to be hooks. We want there to be big fat drum beats. You know, killer riffs, all that stuff. And that comes from playing that stuff out live and getting a feel for what's happening. And we do that more and more with each recording.
Excellent. Well, it's been working, so, yeah.
Thank you.
Let's see. Maybe this is right, maybe not, but I read somewhere that Psychic Warfare took the longest of your records in terms of writing and recording. If that's true, what could you attribute that to?
We did take a long time recording that record. I think the writing process was a long writing process in that we started writing pretty much directly after Earth Rocker was kind of in the can. We started immediately kicking out around ideas. But the recording process, I think it was pretty time consuming. We ended up going to Texas to record with the machine down there, and we did all the basic tracks down there, and that took a couple weeks. And then we moved to Frederick, where we have our own facility there. We call it the Doom Saloon. And so we did all the overdubs there, you know, guitar tracks. Neil did his guitar tracks. Tim did a lot of his tracks there as well. And, you know, that's, I think part of that is just Machine's attention to detail. He's very meticulous in the way he puts his tracks down. On the other hand, you know, for this record, this next thing we're getting ready to do, it's really a clean slate. We haven't really written much of anything at this point. So we're anxious to wrap up this tour and then spend the first half of next year trying to cultivate some material and see where this thing's going to go. It's really early in the process to know what the shape of the album is going to be, but I'm definitely excited to get in there and start trying stuff.
Of course. Now, are you going to figure out the songs first and then decide if you want to work with Machine again, or do you have that pretty much decided?
No, I don't know what we're going to do. I think we'll probably try something different. You know, right now that's what we're thinking. You know, for us, it's very important to try new stuff and to get into new scenarios. It just, as a musician, I think it makes you think a little differently, you know, if you could change your perspective on something. That's good stuff, you know. So right now we're looking to do something different, but, you know, it's still early. Who knows?
Yeah, not holding you to anything, that's fine. All right. Now, from what I understand, some people didn't love the fragmented part of recording Earth Rocker, and like everything was done separately and it was sort of pieced together after the fact, and you got more of an organic feel. Do you have any impression of what you want to do?
Again, too early to say. You know, the way those records were recorded was pretty different. Mm-hmm. You know, Earth Rocker was very micromanaged to the point where I cut drums by myself. Using tracks that were previously recorded, like in a rehearsal, you know, so it was just me and Machine, you know, doing the drums. That's one way to do it. You know, previous to that, we'd done most of our stuff the very old-fashioned way, which is just all, you know, the four of us in a room. You know, with technology these days, I think you can make a record in a lot of different ways, or you can make a record in sort of, maybe a little bit of both, you know. And it's really it's up to you to use the technology to your advantage in the way you want. One thing we try not to do is let the technology become more important than the music, because that's never for this band, that never works. And it's easy to do that. There are plenty of bands who could become very reliant on click tracks and being able to cut and paste everything, and we don't do much of that. We do a lot of editing, but what we do is all live stuff. We don't repeat anything. We don't use a chorus again the next chorus around. You know, there are bands who do that. But, you know, I mean, the recording process can be whatever you want it to be. I'm not here to say that one way is better than another, because, and at the end of the day, I'm very proud of Earth Rocker. That was a great record for us. It's just another way of working.
Of course, there are some bands that take a snare drum from another recording and just use it on...
Yeah, you can do that. You know, you can go down that rabbit hole, and it can... you can spend more time doing that stuff than actually playing, right. You know? But that's, you know, that's, I think that's technology. And that also, I think, holds true for movies, you know, and everything else that people are doing these days, you know? There's so much technology available to you. You have to be mindful that it's a tool, and the technology itself is not, that's not the art, you know?
Psychic Warfare debuted at number 1 on the top rock album charts and number 11 on Billboard 200. It was the best charting and best weekly sales, from what I understand. Do you see this as validating your choices, you know, and...
I see it as being awesome. I think we were all very surprised by that. Very proud of it as well, mostly because we were able to receive those accolades while releasing this thing on our own label. And for me, that was the most gratifying thing of all, you know. We spent many years on other labels, battling with other labels, and those years were always pretty uninspiring when it came to, you know, the business relationship between the band and the label. So to be able to first start our own label and have it do well, and then finally be able to release a record like Psychic Warfare, and to be able to have those kinds of achievements is amazing. It's something that we don't take for granted, and we are very proud of.
All right, so over the years, it seems like Neil has gotten a bit more involved, and he's evolving as a guitar player. How has his role evolved in the songwriting process?
Well, I think we're all better songwriters than we used to be. Neil continues to grow as a musician, and I think we all do. I certainly spend a lot of time practicing and thinking about the drums and trying new stuff. I think that's, you know, that's part of that's the journey of a musician. You know, for me, you have to continue to move forward. You have to always be trying to learn new things. Sometimes relearning something that you thought you knew, you know, that can be a valuable exercise as well. To speak specifically about Neil and his contributions, you know, Neil is the lyricist. So we're very lucky to have him because, in my opinion, he is the best in the business. When I'm in the room with Neil listening to what's happening, my sole intention is to support that vocal line. That's what it is. I'm not worried about trying to blow some chops. I'm not worried about trying to play a tricky fill. I'm not really trying to work out this crazy linear groove that I heard someone do that I thought was dope. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not about any of that stuff. It's about listening to the damn vocal and making that vocal feel good, you know. Once that's sorted out, I do the same thing for the rest of the guys in the band. I'll listen to that bass line. I'll listen to those guitars. What can I do to make those choices sound the best choices they can be? And that's kind of like that's the process, really. That's the songwriting process for me, you know, making those guys feel comfortable and trying to make those decisions the right decisions.
Let's see. I'm curious about the album art, too. You worked with Dan Winters, as always, but how does the image on the front, the Valkyrie flanked by what appear to be cannons, how does that relate to the album itself, if you can speak to that?
Well, Dan Winters has an amazing eye for those sort of very iconic images. And to be totally honest, you know, when he came up with that image, which is, by the way, it's a Library of Congress image. That's not a shot that he took himself. Dan spends hours and hours down there going through photographs and just checking out stuff that he likes. You know, I mean, he's like us music fans, and that he loves photos as much as he does music. So, you know, for him, it's nothing to spend hours and hours there at the Library of Congress checking out these historical documents. So when he came to us with that image, I think we were not expecting anything like that. But we were also blown away just because it looked so badass. You know, it looked tough. And, you know, after all, I think an album cover has to carry that kind of a weight. You know, you have to, that album cover has to be something that you immediately identify not only with the band, but that collection of songs. It should be unique from the previous record. It should stand on its own. And you know, in a lot of ways, you know, you can look at that image and then listen to the music, and you can kind of draw your own parallels, your own, you know, what does that record cover mean? I'm still not totally sure myself, you know, but I look at it every day, you know, and I see new stuff in it, and I see how it relates to the music. And it's a super powerful image, obviously.
You guys re-released Blast Tyrant on vinyl a few years back with some extra unreleased tracks. Are you still sitting on some unreleased songs for each of the albums? I know for Earthrocker, for example, there were, what, 14 written, 11 on the standard album, and then you released Night Hag and Scavengers on the deluxe edition.
Yeah. There are a few songs that are out there floating around that are not released. We do a pretty good job of getting most everything out there eventually, you know. These days, when we go in to record, we really, you know, we start with as many ideas as possible, you know, sometimes 20, 30 ideas, you know, and we just start paring things down, you know, you start going with the most powerful stuff, the stuff that really makes the most impact. Sometimes there's two things that are in the same vein, so you gotta choose, you know, you gotta choose which baby you like best. and so that process is very fluid all the way to the very end. You know, we never say, okay, it's going to be exactly this many songs on a record. We have an idea of what we want to do. But really, when you start to sequence the record, that's really when things start to come together. That's when you start to see the connection between the songs, what songs are going to work on that record, and then what songs might be best suited to leave off so you can use them for something else. Just because you don't put the song on the record doesn't mean it's going to be dead. You know, there are always other uses for that song. So there are a couple things floating around, and I'm sure that when we get into the studio this next year, there will be more of those kinds of things.
Because those are always good incentives when you have the re-releases or deluxe editions, and you know that. So, sure. I mean, that's always good for collectors.
Sure, know? Absolutely. Maybe, you know, there's somebody needs a song for a compilation, or, you know, maybe there's a placement thing for a commercial or a video game of some kind, you know. We've got this stuff in the vault that we can say, hey, this would work good for that, you know.
Now, I understand you're doing stuff with Mark from Lamb of God and Yanni and Chris. Is that the Mark Morton solo album?
Yeah, I think it is going to be a Mark Morton solo album. We've been getting together for about a year and a half now. You know, once every few months we get together and play some music. For me, it's exciting because it's such a different mix of players, very creative people. And so when we get together, stuff happens very fast. So we've amassed already a good collection of music. What exactly the shape of this music is going to be, I'm not sure yet, you know. I know that I enjoy playing with those guys, and the music that we're making, I'm very proud of.
I'm sure that scratches a different itch than what Clutch is, probably.
Sure, yeah, and I try to do that, too, with all my side projects. You know, I'm not really interested in starting another riff rock band.
Yeah.
You know, I like to stretch out and do different stuff. I do blues gigs when I'm at home. You know, I enjoy that. Try other stuff all the time, you know, play with other guys, record some side project stuff. Just because I feel like that's, you know, all that is for the greater good. Never have I been in a situation where I was like, oh, well, this was a cool idea, but I used it for this side project, so now I can't, you know, Clutch is going to hurt from that. It's never like that. I always end up bringing something new to the table because I've been playing with other musicians. And, you know, when the other guys do side projects, I'm sure it's the same for them as well.
After premiering and presumably selling well 5 years ago, your Dark Sour Ale has returned.
Yeah.
What made you bring it back, and where's the best place to get it?
Well, we brought it back because it did very well, first of all. If it hadn't done well, people wouldn't want anything to do with it. It's a very good beer, and it's a formula that the band actually came up with. We work with them on the recipe. The initial batch of beer we actually brewed. We were out there. We did the whole thing ourselves. So this second batch just came out a couple months back. I know they made more of it than they did last time, but I also know that beer distribution is a very political thing. And so, like, you guys have some really killer breweries here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, Pennsylvania, of course, is very protective of their own breweries. So, and the same goes for, you know, all the states. So sometimes it's tough to get those beers. So to answer your question, I'm not sure where you can get it, but it's out there.
Drive down to Maryland?
Drive down to Maryland, get online with beer guys, beer traders. Guys do that all the time, you know. Send me two of those, and I'll send you two of these. And in a lot of ways, I feel like the beer community is kind of like a tape trading community as well. So that's cool.
Can't download a beer.
That's right.
All right. Is there anything being released by Weathermaker Music in the near future that people should keep an ear or eye out for?
Yeah, we're working on a project right now for a springtime release where we're going to do sort of a little mini box set. We're gonna package together Earth Rocker Deluxe, Psychic Warfare, and a Bakerton Group record called El Rojo. So we're gonna box those together in a cool box. It's going to be a limited thing. I think we're going to do 3,000 of them. We'll sign those, and that'll be a special release for the springtime. Try to put a good price on there, you know, give people a good value for the money. And it'll be a cool collection of music because those are records that we're very proud of.
Of course, you're going to take the beginning of next year. You're going to lay it low a little bit, but any other big shows that you'll be doing next year that we can announce?
Well, we'll definitely be going back out in the springtime. You know, probably around May, we'll go out and do a few couple weeks worth of shows. In June, we'll head over to Europe and do some festivals over there. Those are always fun. Probably do some stuff in the summertime as well, you know. So when we say like it'll be a light year's worth of touring, in reality that, you know, that means probably like 100 shows, you know.
More than a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's fine. It's all going toward a new record, so, you know, I'll take a couple months of touring off from you guys and, you know, let you do your thing.
Awesome, thank you.
So I end every interview with this one. Stuck in a desert island, one album the rest of your life, what would it be?
Probably John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. I love John Coltrane's music. I love Elvin Jones's drumming. I think that record in particular is a document to what a special relationship Elvin and John Coltrane shared. That for me, that's a spiritual record, you know. And so that probably would be my desert island disc.
That's great. Awesome. Well, thank you for the interview. And could I trouble you for some radio spots?
Sure.